When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here today on the big program. Lots to get to. Lots to talk about the economy. We've been talking about the economy doing fairly well. Considering the rest of the globe, in fact, Financial Times had a piece that said the U.S. economy on track to grow at double the rate of any other G7 country this year. Biden's killing the economy. Biden's bad. Biden. It looks like, you know, we're moving kind of in the right direction. Strong consumer demand and strong investment. That's what's moved us in the right direction. While the rest of the nations around the world, they're struggling. Germany's struggling badly. And, you know, it's this. And understand, our economy is doing well in spite of the Republican Party and their attempt to drive us into recession, their attempt to hold the country hostage. Still doing well. And I got to tell you, I'm in this weird moment right now because I'm looking at Thomas Massie, the Republican from Kentucky, who evidently is going to hook up with Marjorie Taylor Greene and attempt to throw Mike Johnson out of the speakership. He said he's going to co-sponsor the motion to vacate the chair, which means Johnson could be chucked. Now, remember Kevin McCarthy? Remember him? First time you saw that kind of, you know, ousting, you can have two, could possibly have two. And what they're really trying to tell us, and this is the important part of this, what the Republicans are really trying to say without actually saying it is they don't want to govern. They don't know how to govern. They have no idea what to do. They do not know what they're doing. They have no policy initiatives. They have no ideas for what to do. No vision for the future. They're just waiting for Dear Leader to come with the Heritage Foundation's Project 2025 and have Dear Leader, you know, just run everything. But they've got nothing. And I've been saying this for a while because, look, this is the least productive Congress in my lifetime, at least. This House of Representatives, they haven't even passed messaging bills. No English is the official language nonsense. No border bills. No, hey, we're going to slam the door shut. And look, when you have the control that they have, you have the ability to go through and put the other side on the record. You know it's never going to become law, but you throw out your priorities. You know, when Democrats were in charge, they went after raising the minimum wage, getting health care to more people, expanding educational opportunities, doing some major investments, you know, stuff to help working people. When Republicans got in office, it used to be, you know, they were going to go after abortion. They were going to, you know, go after, you know, birth control and because Griswold's back on the table again. They were going to go after the things to control your life in your bedroom because that's what got their base all tizzied up. Pandering to the evangelicals. Yes, we will be a Christian nation. Yes, it'll be your particular brand of Christian insanity that we'll pursue. They used to pass this stuff. Again, not thinking it would ever become law, but because it was good for business. It was good for politics. It was good to get, you know, people all riled up. The donations would come flowing in and it looked like they were doing something. Looked like they were doing their jobs. This Congress, I don't really don't know what they've done because there aren't even the messaging bills. I don't know what the Republican Party stands for other than chaos. They cannot keep their house in order. And again, I come back to what they're telling us is they don't want to govern. What they're really saying is, yeah, we would really like to have Hakeem Jeffries or we'd really love to have Nancy Pelosi back, because at least we can attack her without having to do our job. And this is the interesting part of this, because the Republicans have gotten used to not being held accountable. All they have to do is go, Democrats, and their base loses their minds. Nancy Pelosi, their base loses their minds. And, you know, I saw this great tweet that, you know, someone put out that said, you know, 95% of conservatism these days is just making up a scenario in your own head and then getting really mad at it. And I'm going, you know, I know it's a joke. I know maybe you were trying to make a funny, but sadly, it's true. The kind of things that the Republicans get all bunched up in the panties about is quite distressing, because most of it isn't even based in reality. Most of it's just stuff that they've heard through the power of their talk radio dominance. That's been spoon-fed to them through the dominance of cable news, that they've been hooked on with the video crack from TikTok and all the rest of them. Yeah, it seems like, you know, the conservatives used to have principles, and I used to respect honest conservatives because they had an ideology, they believed in that ideology, and they could articulate it. I'm struggling with the fact that most people who claim to be conservatives today don't even know what that means, other than we're against Biden and we're against Democrats and whatever. We're against sanity, I guess. And I'm looking at this thing with Mike Johnson, and I'm going, you know, if Speaker Johnson loses his job like Kevin McCarthy did, he's going to lose it for doing his job. I mean, this is the part that gets me. I don't agree with the guy on hardly anything, but we're on the brink of potentially the globe being on fire. And I know the Scott Perrys of the world and the rest of them are all pointing their finger at Biden. Sorry, Biden didn't start the war in Israel and in Gaza. He didn't do that. He didn't tell Putin, yeah, go on. Yeah, you go on. Go into Ukraine. Don't worry about it. He didn't do that. He's tried to help without getting us involved. And what's interesting, you know, I saw a story about, you know, evidently Gen Z is heavily Googling World War III and can I be drafted? Because understand, it's their behinds in this. And what you've got is a Republican Party that is doing nothing. Well, I shouldn't say nothing. They are doing something. They're emboldening our enemies because we don't look functional. We used to stand behind our allies and people that we agree that we supported, and we're not. I mean, I look at Ukraine. This seems like a no-brainer to me. Ukraine is fighting to defend itself from being steamrolled. And the only reason they haven't thus far is because we've given them munitions and arms to help protect themselves and help fight Russia off. If you'd asked me, you know, when this thing started, if it would go this long, I said, no way. But what you've got is a Republican Party that seems to be in the pocket of the Putins. And I'm struggling with that. Because by doing nothing, you're making a decision by default to support them. You know, that question of which side are you on? I think we know which side the Republican Party is on in this moment. Or at least some of the crazies. Now, there are some that are, well, they're trying. There are some that are peeking their head up a little bit. But there's no profiles and courage over there. It's going to be interesting to see where things go, especially as we've got a lot of problems going on. You've got potential wars all over the place. The stuff going on with China. Wow. I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. Quick break. Right back.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors, the American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So I came across this political article that, you know, look, I've been talking about China and the fact that we've gotten ourselves in really deep with our manufacturing. And, you know, you think that, you know, it's you know, widgets and whatnot, and, you know, it's consumer products. And you go, hey, we can ramp up manufacturing. We can make those things here. But I'm looking at this article over at Politico, and they're talking about, you know, how we're going to decouple from all of the other things. And they brought up pharmaceuticals, that evidently one of the big players in making pharmaceuticals that come back here that help, you know, with cancer and with cystic fibrosis and HIV and all kind of other things, produced in part by a company with direct ties to the People's Liberation Army, the military wing of the Chinese Communist Party. And it makes me go, how did we allow that to happen? How did we allow it to happen from the beginning? And now I understand right now there's a Biosecure Act banging around the House, and maybe we get something, but at what cost now? And here to share some thoughts of, well, how did we get here? And can we at this point at all break away? I've asked our good friend Scott Paul to come talk with us. Scott is the president of the Alliance for American Manufacturing, AmericanManufacturing.org, the website. Scott, thanks for taking time for us.
Rick, it is great to be with you.
So we're told, I remember this very, very clearly. We were told if we give the really smart people all the money, they know what to do with it. It'll trickle down and we'll all be wealthier. We were told if we do these trade deals, the really smart people are going to be able to do all these amazing things, and we're going to get really cheap goods. We're going to have a much higher standard of living. It was going to be fabulous. It seems the really smart people kind of screwed things up.
Yeah. I would just generally say, when we as a nation have tried to build a policy around a theory that hasn't been put to a test, it generally hadn't worked out well. it generally hasn't. And you think about that with trickle down, you know, the supply side, the tax cuts, or you think about the free trade. And so you're absolutely right that it was a bunch of nonsense. And what happens when you build in the trade incentives, the tax incentives, the drive for corporate profit incentives that the shareholders have, and it produces a really toxic mix for our economic and national security. They're sidelined, basically. They're not even factored into that. So you do end up with circumstances like the one you point out, where we might innovate an active pharmaceutical ingredient or a new drug, you know, a new treatment, a new therapeutic, and the companies will find it, they can get a higher margin if they have the manufacturing done in China. And China has built up this capability purposefully, right? They've done this purposefully so that they become indispensable in a number of different ways. And you end up with this circumstance that you mentioned. And unfortunately, it's not an isolated circumstance. It applies to many types of antibiotics. It applies to things like heparin, which is used as a blood thinner. in ubiquitous quantities in hospitals around the United States, and many types of supplements, and then a lot of the APIs, active pharmaceutical ingredients that go into the medicines that we all depend on. And unwinding from that is not going to be easy because of the startup manufacturing facilities with a high cost of capital in this country or in others. And the drug companies, they love the margins that they get from producing in China, where there's less regulation, lower labor costs and all of that. So it does not in any way bolster health security, economic security, national security to have a dependency like the one that has been created because of the incentives that you raised up, Rick.
So it really just is about, it can't be just that simple. It's just the money. I mean, to put ourselves in this, because I was thinking about this today. You think about, let's worst case scenario, the Chinese Communist government goes, we're going to attack the U.S. and we're going to do it through drug manufacturing, and we're going to poison people. We're going to do all this stuff. That's the most extreme conspiratorial thinking out there. I don't know why you would allow yourself to be open to that. But the other part is, and the more reasonable is, if we have, hiccups in our relationship, they just cut off supply. Why would we allow ourselves to be that vulnerable to the communist? I grew up at a time where the Soviet Union and communism was bad and it was just beaten into us. And I'm struggling here, Scott. Just struggling.
Look, this is playing out. Fortunately, there is enough testing and what have you that first extreme scenario seems highly unlikely. Just don't go to Russia and piss off Putin. That's the advice I have, right? but the other scenario that you mentioned about the government-induced shortages or even other reasons for it, that has already played out. And we've seen that some because of some of the supply chain disruptions. And as a result, I'm first going to stipulate that there are a lot of reasons why this is happening, but there are hundreds of drugs that are in short supply in the United States right now, in part because of manufacturing bottlenecks and because of this kind of globalized supply chain of active pharmaceutical ingredients. And so it is a real danger. All you have to do is like Google stories about drug shortages and you see what's going on. So it's not it's not something that is like made up sci-fi. Like this is playing out right now and it should be an even greater wake up call. And I think that we can start by insisting that the pharmaceuticals that are being paid for through government programs, which is a massive amount, right? Through Medicare or through the VA, there ought to be some obligation that they're sourced from the United States or at the very worst, I guess, a friendly ally, ideally the United States, but to wean ourselves off of this dependency on what is generically called a foreign entity of concern, which reads China because of the strategic competition we're in now, and just also because of the increasing geopolitical risk that we're seeing and the posture that Beijing's taking on a variety of issues, Rick.
Yeah, I guess I'm stuck in this. Did no one see this as a possibility? Did we not game this out and go, it's probably not a great idea to be this vulnerable? And then look, I understand breaking up's hard to do. Is it possible for us to reclaim this stuff, given the fact that we seem so dependent in virtually every arena? And my problem is you use the word competition. We didn't compete. It's not something that we lost. It's not something that we were both in the ring slugging out. No, we handed this stuff off. And as you pointed out a minute ago, simply so that a handful of people could have more money.
Yeah. So you're right. I would say that we have known about these vulnerabilities for a long time. And I remember one of the first reports at AAM that we did was on a variety of products where there had been health and safety concerns raised because they were being manufactured in China without proper oversight. And one of those was heparin. And there was a case where there was some tainted heparin that actually killed patients in the United States. And we said, it's really hard to maintain quality control there. We ought to look at that. And then there's an author named Rosemary Gibson who raised up these issues about the dependency and the shortages probably a decade ago or more. But it really hasn't come into sharp focus for most people until the pandemic and the aftermath.
So do you think we're ready for this? Yeah. I mean, I was just reading a story over at the New York Times that, you know, they're looking at the EU and asking the question, does the EU have what it takes to fight China on green tech? Because it looks to me like what's going on in the EU, this is the first battleground in China, you know, exerting its dominance and potentially taking over the entire green sector. Do they have the tools to do it? And two, do we?
Yeah. Well, let's look at the EU because it's been interesting. And traditionally, the EU has been the slowest to respond to unfair trade practices in China. And part of the reason for that is that so many of the European multinational companies have far deeper operations in China than even the U.S. companies do. Okay, so there's I think that there's a perception that there's more to lose on that, and I think part of the reluctance, you know, is based on this fact that the whole reason why the EU is formed so that they wouldn't have to go it alone and do this in sort of a head-to-head way with China and could rely on international institutions like the WTO. WTO is broke, right? I mean, it's not, it doesn't have an appellate body. Nothing's ever going to happen there that results in some trade enforcement or some change in behavior by a government that I can see. And so I think that they've kind of reluctantly decided that they do have to guard some of their own industries because they've seen the German solar industry, which got started because of public investment, like we're trying to do here in the United States, just got obliterated by Chinese imports. And the same is about to happen on Chinese electric vehicles, which are about to enter the European market. So this is a big, big headache, and it's becoming, you know, for the European leaders, a problem like both, Biden, Trump have faced in the U.S., which is how do you build up manufacturing, again, and guard against all of these unfair trade practices.
And that is really the big question. How do you make anything when you have to compete with a Chinese communist government that's heavily subsidizing their industries? And I know I hear the arguments, but we get such cheap stuff. And I'm going, I don't even know that we get cheap stuff more than we get, you know, things that are questionable. Because I seem to remember the melamine in baby formula, the lead in children's toys, the dog food that was tainted that killed pets.
Exactly. Yeah,
I seem to remember all those things, and we don't hear about them as often. But I gotta wonder, you know, how far down this rabbit hole are we?
Yeah, well, I mean, so we're pretty far down, and the wonky explanation is that consumers aren't paying, and the companies aren't paying for any of these what we would call externalities in economics, and that's basically all the bad stuff that is happening because the companies are manufacturing there, the labor exploitation, the increased carbon emissions because of the coal-fired plants in China, and the lack of environmental regulation, and then the shipping costs you have going across an ocean, in addition to the direct subsidies that the companies are getting from the government. You add all of that, and that's an enormous cost advantage for the Chinese companies, for the companies that are operating in China. And yes, consumers get a tiny bit of savings from that, but it's not like they would, you know, they could afford, these companies could not dramatically scale up the prices, and they certainly won't take them down. They didn't take them down much when the jobs moved overseas. They pocketed most of that money for themselves, right? They just don't want to have lower margins. Yeah. And I think that's the rub because of the influence that Wall Street shareholders have on this process. And so this, there's a multifaceted approach to all of this, but got to get started.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Lastly, I want to get your thoughts on Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen said the U.S. wasn't going to take anything off the table as they respond to China's manufacturing capacity or overcapacity, because we keep hearing that word, you know, overproduce, overcapacity. We keep hearing that buzzword. What it really means is they're flooding the market with cheap stuff in order to kill off other industries so that they can dominate the globe. But I'm curious what your thoughts of Yellen's comment is.
Yeah. Well, I think it's a step in the right direction. And again, as someone who's highly regarded in international economic circles, I think her words stand out. And so it's important for what I would call the trade hawks in the administration to step forward and to implement this policy and to make it clear, because there is a lot of evidence that there is this overcapacity in China, and it's being fueled by the government. The Chinese growth figures, if you believe them, just came out, and they showed that there was a surprising amount of economic growth in China, but most of it was produced by investment in industry and not by consumption by consumers, right? Which is the way that they should be doing it. And so that means, and this is just the perfect example, that when it comes to automobiles, both the internal combustion engine and the EVs, China has enough excess production to supply 5 to 10 million additional automobiles around the world, more than they could possibly sell in China. And you think about it, Rick, we sell about 15 million cars a year in the United States. So you think about that kind of flood of imports coming in, which is why, you know, Senator Sherrod Brown just said, we had to ban Chinese EVs, period.
Period.
You know, just not, don't even bother with the tariffs or the regular, just ban them. Just say no, so that we stop this problem before we get it started.
So, and even if they go and build them in Mexico, ban them out completely.
Yeah, that's exactly right. From the Chinese companies, because they've had such a government-induced head start. It's like athletes competing in the Olympics with steroids. You just exclude them from the competition, basically.
Yeah. No, we'll see where this goes. But Scott, as always, I appreciate your input. Thanks so much for the time.
Of course, Rick. Appreciate it. Thank you so much for having me on.
Anytime, our good friend Scott Paul. I want to hear your thoughts. Am I being hyperbolic? I guess that's the question. Am I making too much of the fact that we're so dependent on the Chinese Communist Party? I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Quick break, right back.
Sick of being upsold at gyms?
My guy, you're currently a base member. For $90 more, I can upgrade you to our Shred membership. For $130 more, you'll be a Swole member. And for just $300 more, you'll reach Sweat Platinum.
At Planet Fitness, you'll get energy without the upsell. Never pushy, always free fitness training and equipment for every workout. It's fitness that fits your budget. Join Planet Fitness for just $1 down and $10 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, May 10th. See Home Club for details.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
So Monday on the program, you heard us talk about how with just a stroke of a pen, the Florida governor, Ron DeSantis, or as some are calling him, Ron Death Santis, wiped away the ability for local governments there in Florida from requiring I don't know, heat protection for workers, protecting people on the job, make sure they don't die from heat-related injuries. DeSantis, no, we're going to make heat stroke great again. And that's why I've asked our good friend Jordan Barab to come talk with us, former OSHA deputy secretary under the Obama administration, my go-to guy, everything safety, health and safety. Make sure you check out his Confined Spaces blog. We'll get links out on social media. Jordan, thanks for taking time for us.
Happy to be here, Rick.
So what happened? I talked about this on Monday. Death Santis, as they're now calling him, decided, hey, we're gonna make heat stroke great again.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's no secret that it gets hot in Florida. And in fact, Florida is probably the hottest state in the country. The number of heat-related deaths are going up there. The number of days with extreme heat in the summer are rising rapidly. You know, last year was the hottest year on the record in the world, and also in the United States, and also in Florida. So needless to say, you know, Florida's got a big agriculture industry, a big construction industry, a lot of workers working outside, exposed to extreme heat. And some of the localities in Florida thought, you know, maybe we should do something about this. I mean, federal OSHA doesn't have a heat standard yet. They can do some citing under their general duty clause, but that's difficult. So Miami-Dade County commissioners got together last year and decided to put together a local ordinance that would require employers to provide provide shade, rest, and water to outdoor workers in the agriculture construction industry. And the business community went berserk. They were, you know, spreading fears of massive job loss and economic dislocation, destruction of the, you know, the Florida agriculture industry. And so the county council backed off. But that wasn't good enough for DeSantis and the Republican legislature. They passed a law, and DeSantis just signed it last week, that prohibited any locality in Florida from passing any kind of ordinance or regulation that was more strict than the state has to protect workers against heat. And of course, the state doesn't have anything to protect workers against heat. So basically, Miami-Dade and any other locality in Florida is now unable to, in fact, prohibited from passing any kind of ordinance that would force employers to protect workers against heat on the job.
I don't know where you go with that. I mean, you know, the weird, there's so much here. Let's start with the smaller, less intrusive government, thing, a local government argument. Let's start with that. I mean, isn't this kind of a local government thing? Shouldn't this be what, you know, the DeSantis's of the world, what conservatives of the world be going, look, you know, your local communities, not the big state or not the federal government, should be setting these things. Am I missing something here?
Well, yeah, I mean, they believe in states' rights, of course, you know, especially when there's a Democratic president, you know, then the state should be able to do whatever they want. But that doesn't translate down to local rights, you know, city rights, or Miami-Dade to protect its hundreds of thousands of outdoor workers. Then he wants to be the dictator and the big government guy who's going to tell everybody what they have to do.
And then the other part of it is, you hit on it a second ago, the industry started losing their mind. Oh, this, you know, job-killing regulations, job-killing. This is literally a situation of people killing lack of regulation. There are people who are dying from heat-related illnesses, so much so that, as you pointed out, in Miami-Dade, they wanted to actually do something, which is quite remarkable. So I guess the first person who dies from this, does their family get to go back and sue Death Santis and the Republicans for this? I mean, at some point, don't they have to?
One would hope, yeah. I mean, or you know, that there'd be some kind of political awakening in Florida and you know, throw the guy out and throw out the Republicans in the legislature. I mean, this is, you know, I mean, this is a really bad bill. I mean, they have this whole piece of legislation. There's not one word in there that actually recognizes that heat is a hazard. It doesn't, you know, usually there's a preamble saying, you know, X number of workers die and get sick and it's a hazard. Nothing in there that even admits or recognizes that there's even a hazard to deal with. They're just totally into, making sure that employers get their way in every shape and form. And he didn't just sign this about heat. I mean, that's bad enough because it's killing people.
Right.
But, you know, the laws that he signed also prohibit localities from raising the minimum wage among the state wage or putting any kind of requirements, wage and hour, or any kind of requirements on employers that get local contracts. So basically, again, they're saying, you know, the state has priority, and everybody else is prohibited from doing anything to treat their workers better than the state decides to treat them.
Now, this is the mother of preemption bills. And look, a major power grab by the state. And this, again, I come back to, and this is why I find it so interesting that it's DeSantis and Republicans who are doing this, because they're supposed to be the ones who are, government's bad, we should do things local. I guess I'm fixated on that.
Yeah, well, hypocrisy has never been a a good excuse not to do something, especially for Republicans.
You know? No, good point. And as I say, look, Republicans hate working people. Look at what they do. Look at this. This is literally going to kill somebody. And I'm not being hyperbolic. We know that's going to happen, don't we?
No, we absolutely do know that. I mean, OSHA, again, OSHA can cite under what's known as its general duty clause. When it doesn't have, it doesn't have standards, it can use the general duty clause. It's difficult, it's burdensome, and it gets overthrown in court a lot. But just today, OSHA announced a citation in Florida against a company, an agricultural company, whose employee died his first day on the job from heat-related illness. So obviously it's a problem there. I mean, this was last summer. Now we're just getting into this summer. And, this bill becomes effective? July 1st, the height of the summer. They're going to tell everybody that they don't get any heat protections.
I don't know where you, do we hold the moment of silence now so that I can figure out, how to respond to that?
Yeah. I mean, just got to keep drumming on them. You got to keep drumming on them, especially the worker advocates in Florida.
Now, for me, Jordan, this is where I go, okay, well, if the states abdicate their responsibility to protect workers, isn't this where Biden and the federal government should be stepping in and saying, look, if you're going to refuse to do anything to protect people, this is where we have to?
Well, they are. I mean, OSHA is working on a heat standard, but OSHA takes a long time. It takes years and years, sometimes decades, to issue standards. I mean, that's just the way it works for a variety of reasons. So OSHA is working on a standard. They're trying to accelerate it. But I mean, it's obviously not going to happen this administration. And if there's a second Trump administration, it will never happen. Even a second Biden administration, they'll struggle to get it out by the end because it takes so long. So it's not something that Biden doesn't recognize or that OSHA doesn't recognize. It just takes them a long time. And that's why in the meantime, there are states and localities that are deciding they don't want to wait on OSHA. They can act faster and they're acting. And then you have states like Texas, which passed a similar law to the one we're talking about now, and Florida, who are going in the exact opposite direction.
So why does it take so long? I mean, look, I know you were, you're the former acting assistant secretary and deputy assistant secretary of labor for OSHA. You were there. Why does this take so long?
Yeah, that was the most frustrating thing about that job, is that it takes so long to get OSHA regulations out. I mean, part of it is the hurdles that are kind of built into the act. OSHA has to prove there's a significant risk. They have to prove that it's economically and technologically feasible in every possible industry that it'll affect. Congress has passed additional laws making it harder to get regulations out. The White House, in Republican and Democratic administrations, have passed executive orders that slow down the process. And that on top of the fact that OSHA has a tiny, tiny budget, about $500 million compared to, I think it's $10 billion now for EPA. And they just don't have very many staff to actually issue these regulations.
I guess
Trump, in fact, cut OSHA's regulatory budget by 10%. And only last year did it finally catch up to where it was before the Trump administration. And now, because of, the deals, the budget deals on the Hill, you basically got flat budgets, which means budget cuts, with inflation. So, OSHA's, hamstrung, everywhere you look. And basically, the regulatory process is broken over at OSHA.
I guess it shows what we think of working people. Honestly, yeah. when you put it the way you do. But this one seems simple to me. And maybe it's just that I'm someone who's worked in really hot environments. And our union has always gone to bat for our workers. And this, again, another reason I believe all working people should join and form unions, so that you have the ability to deal with these issues on the job. But, when temperatures get above 95 degrees, every hour you get, 5 minutes to cool down and get a drink. I don't know that that's so difficult to come up with. Pick a temperature where scientists are saying, hey, this is where the body starts to break down. Let's get a water break. Let's cool down. And it's not going to kill productivity.
No,
I just,
this is not, you know, rocket science, as I say. It's not difficult. We know what to do. We know how to prevent heat related illness. It's just a matter of doing it. You know, when we remember Deepwater Horizon, you had thousands of workers cleaning up the beaches there, and they had imported all these workers from New Orleans, and a lot of them were in really bad shape. They're wearing Tyvek suits, and we looked at that and we said, holy shit, you know, a lot of these guys are going to die and end up in the hospital. So we, you know, worked out a deal with BP and with the Coast Guard that they would basically do what we said. And we had workers that were they were working like 20 minutes an hour. You know, they'd work for 10 minutes, take, you know, 20 minutes off, work for another 10 minutes, take 20 minutes off. We had a lot of complaints from the governor saying, you know, I used to mow lawns, you know, when I was a kid in the hot weather.
Yeah, yeah.
But the fact was, not one worker got sent to the hospital. We didn't lose anybody because of that. So, again, we know what to do. It's just a matter of the political will to do it.
Yeah, no, I've been in those suits. It's not doing anything in those suits is not just any other day. I've done the whole SCBA, you know, with the mask and the self-contained, all of that. And
yeah,
it's not good, especially on the hot days. And again, in my workplace, where we had a union, we negotiated how long you could be in and how long you had to be out. These were problems we could solve locally. But sadly, again, what's happened over the last 50 years is of late, labor has been under attack, and the ability to solve these problems locally, unfortunately, has been diminished, which is why we need states with strong regulations to protect workers, why we need a federal government with strong regulations to protect workers' health. I just don't know any other way.
No, exactly. And you know, what's particularly insulting and you know, just displays how little understanding these guys have over what goes on in a workplace was, if you read the preamble to the law, it says that one of the major problems with ordinances like Miami-Dade was considering was that they, and this is a quote, ignore the individual responsibility of an employee to follow relevant guidance and to protect him or herself from heat-related illness. Right. I mean, they're basically blaming the worker for their own illnesses. They're putting all the burden on workers to be able to somehow just have the agency to go take a drink of water anytime they want, or rest anytime they want, or find a shady area anytime they want, which obviously workers, especially non-union, low paid, vulnerable workers, aren't going to ever be able to do. I mean, it's just insulting and just shows how little understanding they have. And even, I mean, to add to that, I mean, this law they've had doesn't just prohibit employers from being required to provide water and shade. It prohibits employers from being required to even provide training or even putting up signs that warn about heat. So, I mean, on one hand, you're saying workers need to have agency and take responsibility for their own health and safety and figure out, you know, how to protect themselves, assuming they have the ability to do that. On the other hand, their employers aren't even required to educate workers about, you know, what they have to do to protect themselves. I mean, it's just absurd. And it's, you know, again, as you say, workers are going to die, and the blood is on the hands of the Florida legislature and the governor.
So you said something that, you know, again, grabbed my attention, because basically this language of blaming the victim, of blaming the worker for their injury. This takes me back to, you know, I studied labor history. This goes back to pre workers' comp days, where, you know, yeah, they would go into court and, well, you know, the worker slipped and fell into the vat of steel. You know, granted, there were no, you know, gates up. There was no protection for them. Granted, there were, you know, no covers or anything. You know, he tripped. It was his fault. He shouldn't have tripped. This harkens to that. And so there's part of me that asks, you know, and I know you can't answer this, but there's part of me that asks the question of, was that put there specifically to begin that kind of process of not just heat-related injuries, but all injuries being able to be blamed on the individual?
Exactly. As you indicated, I mean, over 100 years ago, before there was workers' comp, you know, employers, you know, would blame workers. I mean, they're too lazy, you know, they're careless, you know, they're just, you know, killing themselves. And the whole point of workers' comp was to be, you know, basically blameless. You know, it was, you know, you got hurt, you got compensated. That was it. And OSHA finally came in and put the actual responsibility on employers, not on workers, but on employers who control the work site, to ensure that their workplaces are safe.
Yeah.
And this just goes totally in the opposite direction of that.
Yeah, it's just amazing to me that we're in this moment. And I guess this is 50 years of a right-wing attack on organized labor, on educating workers. And I'm not surprised by it. And look, you know, you look at states like my state of Pennsylvania, and there are attacks on workers' comp laws. There are attacks on right to organize laws. I'm hoping we wake up pretty soon.
Well, you know, I mean, it's an election year, right? I mean, this should be an issue that people are voting on.
Yeah, no, I'm hoping you're right. Jordan, I appreciate the time. Hope folks will check out the website, jordanbarab.com/confined space. We'll get links out on social media. I can take a look at the great work he does. Jordan, thanks so much.
All right, you're welcome, Rick. Happy to be here.
Appreciate the time. Jordan Barab, former acting assistant secretary and deputy assistant secretary of labor for OSHA. I want to hear your thoughts. What's it like in your workplace? Are there heat standards in your neck of the woods? Or is this left up to the benevolent employer? If he thinks it's hot enough for you to get a drink of water, and can you leave your workspace whenever you want? I want to hear it. Rick at the ricksmithshow.com. Right back. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1912. That was a day of tragedy for workers in the gold fields of Serbia. Gold miners by the Lena River in southeast Serbia worked under brutal conditions. The Lena Gold Mining Joint Stock Company ran the mining operation. The lucrative gold mines lined the pockets of shareholders, including Russian aristocrats and British industrialists. But the workers saw very little of the bounty they mined. They toiled for 16 hours a day for low wages. To make matters worse, workers were often paid in coupons they could cash in for food at the company store. The quality of the food was poor. A staggering 700 accidents occurred for every 1,000 workers in the mines. At the end of February, when one group of workers was given rancid meat, they had finally had enough. The workers walked out on strike. Soon they were joined by thousands of their comrades. They formed a strike committee and demanded an 8-hour day, 30% wage increase, better food, and improved workplace conditions. At first, the company agreed to talk to the workers, but negotiations went nowhere. Troops were called in and arrested the entire strike committee. Workers rallied to demand the release of their leaders. A crowd of 2,500 striking workers gathered. The troops fired into the unarmed crowd, wounding an estimated 500 workers and killing more than 250. As outraged workers across the country learned of the massacre, a wave of workers' strikes and protests swept throughout Russia. On May Day, 300,000 workers marched in the streets for the 8-hour day. The gold miners continued their strike throughout the summer, but to no avail. Thousands eventually left the gold fields to find less brutal work elsewhere.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
So it's interesting talking with Jordan about this, the fact that we don't really have strong regulations in place. We don't. And it's about time that we do. And look, you know, when DeSantis does this, people are going to die. That's the reality. We know that's going to happen. In fact, last September, you had a 26-year-old man go from Mexico to South Florida. He was here on a work visa, an H-2A work visa. Temporary seasonal non-immigrant worker visa. Because look, we need people to pick the crops, and in Florida especially. So he went there to get some work, needs to feed his family. A hot day, 97 degrees, heat index high. This 26-year-old guy's 4 days, he's on the job. 4 days, he's here from Mexico. He suffers a fatal heat-related injury, dies. Where he was, 20 minutes from the closest road, 22 miles from the nearest hospital where he was transported and later died because of heat stroke. And again, these are things that can be mitigated. In fact, you know, one of the things they talked about in the press release is, you know, this guy's only been in the country 4 days. Different heat probably from where he's from to Florida. Florida, hot. Just allowing the guy to get acclimated to the weather conditions. I know myself, you know, the change of season, it takes a little time to get used to it being really cold or really hot. And these employers, they don't care. I mean, this is the part, you know, where we as Americans, we as, you know, maybe, you know, me as a union guy, many people who work in offices and don't really think about how desperate a lot of working people are. This idea that, oh, we could just go take a break whenever you want, have some personal responsibility. No, that's not how it works in a lot of these places. You work or you don't get to come back. You work or they turn you in. You work or bad things happen. So, you know, I look at this and I'm going, you know, it's horrible that this guy, 26 years old, healthy guy, dead. If that's not bad enough, the company responsible for this, and look, the OSHA, you know, found them responsible. There are things they could have and should have done to ensure that people had water breaks, rest shade areas, that kind of stuff, to ensure that they don't. Maybe someone watching over to make sure that, hey, you're not sweating. That's bad. The worst part of it is the McNeil Labor Management Group. They face a whopping fine and an almost unpayable fine of $27,655. That's the amount set by federal statute. So this guy's life is worth $27,655, which, you know, not surprising. I'll to be honest, I thought it was going to be lower. Now the reality is that this could have been prevented. And oh, shocker of all shockers, the company, they're fighting it, because of course they are. So the question I have is, when do we as working people say enough is enough? And, or is it this, well, he's just a temporary seasonal migrant worker. We don't really care about them. You know, remember that thing that labor saying in the old days, an injury to one, injury to all? If you allow it to happen to him, eventually it's going to happen to you. Maybe we protect people with sane, rational, reasonable regulation. I don't think it's unreasonable to get an extra couple minutes to get a drink or sit in the shade when you stop sweating. Seems kind of smart. Also, some good news. The Biden administration on Tuesday, they have agreed to some new silica dust standards. They are going to limit the exposure of silica dust, a toxic dust. One of the things that kills people. Because understand, you know, what we're seeing right now is not grandpa's black lung. No. In fact, what we're seeing is younger people getting sicker because of the technological advancements. We're now using much better drilling technology, which means we're cutting into more layers of rock that contain silica just to get to the really fine, you know, the thin seams of coal. Because we're scraping the bottom of the barrel right now, and we got to get every bit of it. And what does that mean? Well, that means you've got young people developing severe respiratory issues. You know, black lung is one of those things that everyone knows about. It's what miners get because they go down into the ground and the dust and the coal dust, the silica, all this stuff. You end up getting not just black lung, but you get progressive massive fibrosis, lung cancer, chronic bronchitis, kidney diseases. There's so much here. So the Biden administration has issued some new guidelines. They are reducing the allowable silica dust levels to 50 micrograms per cubic meter. And what does that mean? It means it's a much smaller amount than it used to be. And with an action level of 25 micrograms for an 8-hour workday, what they're saying is we got to figure out how we, I don't know, have people getting sick and dying, especially as the numbers of people who are in the mining industry are going down. The number of people who are getting sick seems, as a percentage of the people who are doing the job, seem to be going up. And as I said, coal miners make up, you know, a minor number of our miners, about 55,000 people nationwide are in the coal mining industry. You compare that with people who are mining metals and non-metal and stone and sand, gravel, all that stuff with about 200,000. This respiratory rule helps them as well. It also updates respiratory protection standards, which means, you know, maybe, I don't know, having a mask. In addition to this silica dust standard, the rule also applies to diesel particle matter and asbestos. That is a good thing. So the coal dust for coal miners, it'll be a year from Thursday. For other mine operators, it'll be 2026 when the standard goes into place. Good stuff. I mean, and well overdue. Something that should have been done years ago. Again, getting things done. Common sense. Why it's taken so long, I don't know. But good on Joe Biden and the administration. And finally, Chris from Oakland sent me an email, with the subject line of which side are you on? He says, Rick, at the end of your show, you closed with that question. He says, as a veteran, as the father of two veterans, one combat vet, as an American, my answer is in the attached meme. Thank you for your voice. See you at the polls. And the meme was the United States of America or the Republican Party. In 2025, only one of these is likely to still exist as we know it today. It's time to pick a side. And he says, I'm betting on the USA, and I am as well, Chris. Thanks so much for the email. And look, you know, this again, like a lot of things, it's a which side are you on type of scenario. Are you on the side of workers and safety? Are you on the side of corporations and profit? Or are you on the side of workers and safety? I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. As always, if you miss any portion of the program, grab the podcast for your audio pleasure. Also, freespeech.org is where you find the video. As always, thanks so much for being here. We'll see you back here next time.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Email Rick. Email Rick at rick@thericksmithshow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.